Thank you.
With that being said, it's still 10:08 a.m. and it's Friday, June the 20th, and we'll now call the meeting of the Finance Commission to order pursuant to Chapter 551 of the Government Code. Rosie Morris and Troy Landon have contacted me and indicated they will not be able to attend this meeting due to business and personal conflicts. They requested that their absences be excused. In accordance with the Finance Code 11.103, the commission members will take a vote to either accept or deny this request. All in favor of excusing these absences, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say nay. The ayes have it, and their absences are excused. At this time, Commissioner Cooper will do a roll call.
For the record, Philip Holt.
Present.
Bob Boytrow.
Present.
Hector Cerner.
Present.
Kathleen Fields.
Present.
Marty Green.
Present.
Troy Lambin is absent. Sharon McCormick.
Present.
And Rosie Morris is absent. David Osborne.
Present.
And Miguel Romano.
Present.
And Laura Warren.
Present.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum, non-present, so we have a quorum.
Thank you. We'll now move on to Finance Commission matters. If there's anyone wishing to address the commission during the time of public comment, you'll need to complete the witness affidavit form and bring that to the front. Public comments on agenda items are limited to 5 minutes, and non-agenda items are 5 minutes as well. Any comments relating to a rule may be made at the time of the rule discussion. In accordance with the Finance Commission's policy on testimony, public comments are not allowed on agenda items related to the final rule adoption, except upon the majority vote of the commission, in which the comments are limited to 5 minutes. Do we have any audience members wishing to make a general comment today? Seeing none. Members, before we take consent agenda items A1, B2 through B4 in a single vote, I want to state that any commission member may request that an agenda item be removed from the consent agenda and placed on the regular agenda so it may be discussed and voted on individually. As a reminder, also members, please state your name before making or seconding the motion. Do I hear a motion to adopt consent items, agenda items A1, B2 through B4 without any discussion?
Laura Warren, so moved.
Thank you, ma'am. Any second?
Kathleen Fields, second.
Thank you. Any discussion, members? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. Motion carries. Now I'll move on to item 4, Finance Commission Operations.
Mr. Chairman, just some general comments. As y'all know, the legislative session ended on June the 2nd. That's some details. There were 9,014 bills filed, 1,231 passed, and sent to the governor. That's about 14%. As of June 16th, there were 321 bills signed by the governor. Under the rules, if a bill was sent in the last 10 days of the session, the governor has 20 days to, after signed off to act. So this gives the governor until Sunday, June the 22nd, to act on these bills. So he's as you can see, he's vetoing some of them. So there's still a little bit of time left. Each agency in our individual sessions will be presenting activity on bills that impact us directly and or indirectly. So we'll refer to that, Mr. Chairman, when that happens.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Item 5. Madam Chair, your audit report.
Yeah. As the audit committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approved the Texas Department of Banking's 2025 Revenue Processing Audit and follow up on prior year recommendations report as prepared and presented by Garza Gonzalez and Associates.
Coming upon the recommendation of the Audit Committee, no second is needed. Members, do we have any discussion? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. Motion carries.
The Audit Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the Texas Department of Banking's 2025 Annual Internal Audit Report as prepared and presented by Garza Gonzalez and Associates.
Coming upon the recommendation from the Audit Committee, no second is needed. Members, do we have any discussion on this matter? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. Motion carries.
Okay. The Audit Committee would like to make a motion that the Finance Commission approve the revised Texas Financial Education Endowment Fund Grant Administration and Advisory Policy Manual and 2026-2027 Funding Priorities.
Coming upon the recommendation from the audit committee, no second is needed. Members, do we have any discussions on this? Hearing none, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it, motion carries.
The audit committee would like to make a motion that the finance commission approve an amount of $850,000 for the upcoming 2026-2027 grant cycle for the Texas Financial Education Endowment.
Just a quick comment real quick. This is a tremendous amount of money being spent, so I certainly appreciate everyone. I know Commissioner Morris and Commissioner Warren are both on this, and I applaud you for reaching this level of grant giving, so well done. Coming upon the recommendation of the audit committee, no second is needed. Any discussion, members? All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it, the motion carries.
That concludes my report.
Moving on to items six through 10, commissioners, do you have any items to be discussed in this open session on items six through 10? Commissioner Reda, anything?
No.
No, sir.
We'll now move on to the Department of Savings and Mortgage Lending. Commissioner Reda.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll go then to page 17. That's where the report begins for the department. First section deals with the state savings banks. As of the end of March, we had 21 state savings banks with assets just over $303 billion. Of that, we had four informal and two formal supervisory actions in place. We anticipate that in August, at the next finance commission meeting, that we will have the percentage of well-rated banks go up because we have seen a couple of the banks in transition or will be able to transition based on their addressing some of the issues that were identified and on improved performance in place. We look now at the different metrics that we review the banks and the median performance of the portfolio. Overall, the portfolio has been stable in an environment with competitive deposits and with other indicators as shown here. In terms of the capital, I'm now on page 118. You can see that the two measures that we take in terms of median total risk-based capital ratio and the minimum total risk-based capital ratio, both are well in excess of the minimums that are in place. With respect to earnings, further down on the page, the net interest margin is at 3.65, so has recovered slightly from what we had been reporting before in September. And so the other point in here too is that non-performing assets, reflecting the asset quality, they remain low at 0.35 to total assets. On the next page, beginning at the top of page 19, we report on the sensitivity to changing interest rates over time or market risk. And there, the measure of long-term assets to total assets ratio decreased slightly to 43.58. And then in terms of liquidity, further down the page, the measures that we take there, net loans to deposits and net non-core funding dependence, both are healthy. And again, as I've referenced earlier, stable. In terms of our, and I'll move now to the top of page 20, in terms of our thrift examination activity, examinations are tracking at or really above what we have expected, so we're performing well there. In terms of the mortgage regulation division activities, the report begins on the next page, well, actually on the same page, on page 19, but I would draw your attention to the next page and the paragraph two-thirds of the way down that summarizes the information with respect to the licenses. We have seen the mortgage industry, as you can see by some of the licenses, and you'll see from some of the numbers that are reported on the next page, has improved year over year, but it's good to keep in mind that 2023 was really quite a down year, especially compared to the previous years, 2020 to 2022, when you did have a post-pandemic buying surge. If you look at it, the numbers, and I'll take you now to page 22, the tables that are shown here, 2022, 2023, 2024, they show the year-over-year differences that I referenced earlier, and you can look at those and see what the change has been in terms of the volume of activity. Again, it's an improvement largely based on 2023 not being a particularly stellar year. And again, on the mortgage loan volume, you can see that there, about two-thirds of the way down the page, on page 22. Looking at the licensing activity report, we processed 2,225 applications between March 1st and April 30th, and approved $1,977. The next section reports on the mortgage examination activity. The mortgage examination section has issued 49 examinations, again from March 1st to the end of April, covering 1,252 individual licenses. And it's up in terms of the number of examinations, up by almost 17%, slightly down on the individual licenses, but that reflects the number of individual licenses who are at the entities themselves. We report then on the violations, and the most common violation that we see in here is the unlicensed independent loan processors and unlicensed residential mortgage loan originators. And that's constant really from month to month and from quarter to quarter. I'll go now to the outreach and training segment of the mortgage side, which is on page 23. We did have the director of mortgage regulation, William Peirce. He attended the Texas Mortgage Bank Association's annual conference. And then both I and Director Peirce attended the Mortgage Policy Summit in Washington, D.C., which was an excellent opportunity to interact and to hear an update with respect to mortgage regulation in the market overall and in industry developments that affected that. That was quite a full day with a lot of excellent information. And you can see by the topics that were covered, a lot of excellent information that was presented. The next section is on the operations division at the bottom of page 23. The staff is working on closing out the third quarter and begun the budgeting process that we referenced earlier during the audit committee. A lot of work will go into the budgeting process during the month of July. With respect to audit, we reported on that, and we referenced here some of the audits, the SDSI audit, post-payment and procurement audit that went through the department, and which were concluded or nearly concluded in one case. In terms of human resources, we have 64 regular full-time employees. And then we show that we have we'll be hiring 5 new hires, we'll put it that way. There's a note in here that says we're hiring 1 cybersecurity analyst as subsequent to us submitting this information. The cybersecurity analyst earlier this year actually ended up not accepting our offer. They did accept it, but then they decided that they received a good offer where they were. And so they were retained by where they were. So we're now back and opening the posting to be able to hire a cybersecurity analyst. I'll take you now then to the next page, to page 25. In terms of outreach and training, I do note there last meeting I had referenced that we were having the first in-person agency-wide meeting, the first since 2019. We planned one in 2020, but with the pandemic, it ended up not happening. So we did have the summit, as we called it, and the theme of it really was fostering a lot of collaboration and strengthening connections, because we had a significant percentage of staff that had been hired since 2020. So it was an excellent experience, I must say. We had the survey feedback from all the participants and had a score of 4.6 out of 5. I have to say that it was a very energetic environment with reports from the different divisions, interactive format, interactive activities, problem solving, and a deeper dive into work styles to understand how to better work with people who have different styles of work and getting things done. So I found it to be extremely productive. And again, the feedback was good, was really excellent. And bottom of page 25, strategic projects, initiatives, and information resources. The mortgage grant fund cycle is in 2025-2026 is in progress. We do have the records retention recertification, but we're on track to finish that by October 2025. And then the IT legacy modernization project is ongoing. We referenced some of that when we were talking in the executive session about some of the steps we've taken there to really continue to develop all of the IT related work that is done, with the focus really on the cybersecurity side as well. Then on the top of page 26, we have the policy and procedure updates. You can see that in May, it was a better month relative to the month before. A lot of it reflects how much time is available to be able to draft and to approve, read through it, review and approve the new and revised agency policies and procedures. But we're on track to be able to finish that, we think, within the next 12 to 18 months, to have all of our policies and procedures documented in the same format. the bottom of that same page, the legal division activities, I'll start with reporting on the customer complaints. We received 868 complaints fiscal year to date through April 30th. And it's a slight 0.1 increase over before. You can see by the boxes, the tables that are presented here, loan servicing continues to be the largest of types of complaints received, and then mortgage banker by respondent type, as you can see there. In terms of the aging of open complaints, 100% of complaints were addressed within or opened within 120 days or less. And then on the bottom of the page, you can see the closed complaints, both of them tracking at 100% or close to 100%, 100% in one case, 99% in the other case. So those are, I think, well within the acceptable means of what we would like. And now for moving forward with the legal and enforcement activity report, if there are no questions, I would ask General Counsel Ian Berry to come forward and present that.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. So we're continuing on page 27, this is 28. Typical reporting here. We'll direct your attention to three quarters of the way down the page, contested cases at SOA. I mentioned last meeting we had a pending SOA action, and I mentioned that we were set for a hearing on May the 6th, and this was against a residential mortgage loan originator accused of improper and fraudulent dealings, and that had to do with mortgage fraud. And so leading up to the date of the hearing on April the 24th, she withdrew her appeal, and that meant we didn't have to have that hearing. And so a final order revoking the license was issued, and the case was dismissed. So that case will fall off. On the following page, page 29, public information requests, future rules activity. You all mentioned on future rules activity, and this is mentioned in the legislative summary that follows this report, but there were a couple of bills that may impact our licensing rules that have to do with residential mortgage loan originators, and this has to do with House Bill 5629 and Senate Bill 1818 having to do with the licensing of military service members, military veterans, and military spouses. A couple sessions ago, the legislature expanded those provisions for licensing military veterans and military spouses to make it easier for those folks who are living here on that business, doing that work for our country, to get that license. They've come back and sort of reworked how it all works. And so we don't think we need to make too many changes, but we are looking at possibly making some amendments to those licensing rules, and that would be in 7TAC 51.110. And so we're looking at that. So we could just think of in the future rules activity, you may see that coming down the pipe. The other thing we're looking at, it's not on this list because it's the rules of all three agencies, but so this has to do with the payoff statement rule review. And so this is, again, the rules of the three agencies, and this is located in 8TAC Chapter 155, having to do with payoff statements, hence the name. And so SML is the lead agency on that. We held off a little bit. We wanted the legislature to convene, and then signee died, so we could see if they made any changes to that. They did not. And so we can move forward with that rule review. On the issue of the legislature, we do have a legislative report, and again, it follows this report. I don't have the page number in front of me, but the entire report is 23 pages long. It has some pretty good analysis of both bills that impact the regulated industries and bills that affect SML itself. Happy to answer any questions about those. I heard mention of increasing audit requirements, and so if you want to touch on that bill and take a look at a closer look at that, that is going to be on page 40 of your packet, and that's House Bill 12. And it changes the process for the sunset review, and includes more audits, more in-depth audits, including about rulemaking, and also efficiency audits by the state auditor's office. So more audits are coming. So there's that. And by way of updates to the summary, I can tell you that After this was published on June the 16th, Senate Bill 4 was signed by the governor. Senate Bill 4 increases the homestead exemption from property taxes from $100,000 to $140,000. So that was signed on June 16th. So that's an update there. That will not be implemented or effective until constitutional changes are made. And so that now has to go before Texas voters. I suspect they will approve it, and that will kick in later. I also wanted to mention, so in your packet, again, you have the report of what did pass. We also need to mention what did not pass. And so you may recall, this was back in October during SML's mortgage regulation rule review. We had a certain rule having to do with the licensing of mortgage companies. And that bill was, that section was Senate Act 56-100. Part of that rule explained the exemption in the finance code from licensing requirements for the mortgage company license having to do with seller finance lenders. The rule clarified those requirements in the finance code. You may recall there was some debate, some testimony that you all heard. We had some witnesses here. And so with that particular rule, while the while most of the rules were adopted in November of 2024, that particular rule and a couple of others were delayed. And so that particular rule was is set to be effective on January the 1st, 2026. And so we held off in part to allow the legislature, if they wanted to take an action to change those requirements in the finance code, they had the opportunity to do that. And so the legislature did take a crack at it. House Bill 4166 was filed, and Senate Bill 2508 where it was filed. Those were companion pieces, one on the House, one on the Senate. And so the legislature did look at that issue, and House Bill 4166 was the only bill that got a vote on the floor, and it was voted down. And so our rule, again, was published. It's set to be effective, and we see no reason to make any changes to that. The rule will kick in January the 1st. Just wanted to follow up with you on that issue. And we also wanted to give industry a little bit of time to comply, come into compliance with the existing requirements of the finance code. And so they've had the benefit of that time over a year. And so we feel like we're in a good position to implement that rule. The other thing I'll mention, in addition to, you have the legislative summary here. The other thing we did is we do emerging issues calls every month with industry, both on the mortgage side and on the thrift side. And so during each of those meetings, we throughout session had updates about bills that were pending and bills that could be passed, and gave updates along the way. And then in this last meeting, we presented the bills that passed. And so they sort of got a curated list of the bills in the summary, each of the industries. So we feel like we've gotten some good word out, and industry knows what's coming, and they can get things ready for those bills to be implemented. Let's see. And that's really all I wanted to cover in this space. Happy to answer your questions.
Any questions, members of Mr. Gray, this morning?
Thank you, sir. And we handled the rules on the consent agenda, Mr. Chairman. So
perfect. Thank
you. Take my leave. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes the report.
Thank you, Commissioner Reddick. Members will now be moving on to Texas Department of Banking, Commissioner Cooper.
Thank you. Ours starts on page 81. All of the data on this page is the same that you looked at the last meeting, so I'm not going to go into that unless anybody has any specific questions. When you go to page 82, it's the same situation, the same data, which is the end of second quarter. Yeah, going on page 83, at the top of the page, same data as you've seen before. But down at the bottom with the chart, it gives you compliance with our examination priorities, and it says of the end of April. So I'd like to make a few comments. You can see, for instance, bank examinations, we have 9 exams passed due by an average of 29 days. So that's kind of the information it's got there. And you're going to hear more about this from our, in the HR section, but we are trying to train in our training for examiners. We're also trying to hire experienced examiners. With the cutback at the federal level, we are getting a lot of applications of experienced personnel. So we think we'll be able to pick up there. And the cutback at the federal level, that could be a completely different, another story for us to talk about. It's going to have ramifications that we don't quite understand yet, but we're dealing with it. For the present, I'm going to say that our staff is running at full speed. And we're going to remain, until we can get fully staffed, we're going to remain below our guidelines, similar to kind of where you see it right now. But, and I've told you all this before, but my charge to the staff is that we are to be as efficient as possible, but we're not going to compromise our standards. And that takes a lot of judgment to do that. And so far, I think we're effectively utilizing our time. On page 84, the highlights, so just generally speaking, obviously the things where we have an area of focus, interest rates, and that's still an issue. The deposit competition continues at a high level. As I mentioned, we are monitoring the impact of staff reductions at the federal level. And let me just give you an example. It hasn't happened as much in the Dallas region, but it's happened in other regions across the country. We may have, for instance, the last exam, there may have been, let's just say, if it was a joint exam, we could have had six FDIC personnel and six banking department personnel, a total of 12, and now they may only send four. And so somewhere or another, we've got to pick up the slack or cut back on some things. So that's what we're dealing with. We're obviously monitoring the impact on tariffs on the banking sector, and obviously cybersecurity remains an item that we deal with. And starting at the middle of the page, going on down, this is all the things you see that we're continuing to be active in various things. The last bullet point at the bottom of the page, I wanted to mention that the banking department and the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas held a conference. About 200 bankers were there. David Osborne participated on a panel, but the point I was trying to, this is a new collaboration we've had with the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. They are asking the banking department to participate as they do presentations or seminars, and we're certainly happy to do that. Then on 86, the applications, if you look on 87, you'll see and Dan Fraser is director, is in the audience. You see that I think this may be the third time that we've kind of used this form. It shows you applications in, what's happened and applications out. You see that the MSB application process is still, I think Dan uses the term robust, robust. But in this particular case, for this time period, we're down two, so to speak. So that continues to be a focus of our attention. Then in division highlights, I just want to make a comment about this. And some of you may have read the industry bank shares banks, and there's six, there's three state banks and three national banks, has had some negative press. And the Cadence Bank, which is based in Mississippi, has submitted the notice to us, or has filed an application to acquire these banks. That has been approved, and they're in the process, if you will, of moving forward with buying these banks. And then Cadence Bank, NIA Bells, has applied to convert to our charter. And we have, I think, three national banks in process of converting to our charter. So that continues. Citizens State Bank in Grenada was merged into the Yoakum National Bank, so we lost one bank there. Then beginning on page 88 would be the non-depository activity. Same issue there, the data on page 88 and the data on page 89 is the same as you've seen before. Going up to page 90, same thing. Let me make a few comments. We're down. We're trying to fill four positions now as of May the 20th. Three of the vacancies are in the MSB area, and then one on the PFC and PCC area. I think we've got some good applicants there. We're going to go into the status of the HR postings here in just a minute. The other point I'd like to mention is that Jesse Sosio, the director, Jesse continues to be highly involved at the national level. He's on the board of the Money Transmitter Regulators Association and also a member of, we call it MMET, which is the Multi-State MSB Examination Task Force, and a lot of enforcement activity and examination activity that runs through that, because we do a lot of our examinations joint with other states. And then finally, I'd like to mention last week, the U.S. Senate passed what was called the Genius Act. You probably saw some, that was this week. You probably saw, I think yesterday and day before yesterday, there was some information about it. This has to do with stablecoin activity. Theoretically, it was only about stablecoin activity. The original version of the bill had some provisions in there that were, in my opinion, very dangerous. Most of those provisions were modified to make the bill a lot better, but we still have some concerns over it. I'll give you a short version. Is the old bill allowed uninsured state banks to operate nationally without, for instance, an uninsured bank in Wyoming could come into Texas and operate without any oversight by us or any restrictions. Most of that was taken out, but there's still some kind of funny language in there that we hope it will be corrected in the House version. But that's pretty concerning. And I know that the TBA and ICBA and Independent Bank Association of Texas have really been voicing their concern about that also. So that's all the kind of the examination activity. If you have questions, I'd like to call Pam Pennington up and talk about HR.
Good morning, Commissioner and members. On page 93 of your materials, you'll find the department's Human Resources Divisional Report. As of June 1st, the department had 14 active postings and 14 closed postings in a selection status. On June 2nd, the department welcomed 7 new assistant financial examiners, 2 accounting technicians or summer interns, and 1 IT support specialist to our team. We promoted 1 employee via competitive selection and have extended 5 offers of employment to senior level examiners and 1 assistant examiner which have been accepted, and those folks start in July and August of this year. Since our last report, the department bid farewell to 10 department employees, leaving the department with an FTE count of 196 as of today. Unfortunately, we are losing 5 additional employees at the end of this month, which will drop our FTE count to 191 beginning in July. But the department will welcome some of the previously mentioned examiners next month, increasing our FTE count to 194 by July 14th. That being said, thus far for the fiscal year, we have successfully onboarded 21 employees, but unfortunately lost 23, leaving the department with an approximate turnover rate of 11 to 12% for the fiscal year thus far. Last report, we anticipated seeing an increase in our overall staff count going into this quarter, placing the department in the 200 FTE range. However, with the potential work from home policy changes that disseminated down this last quarter, job security concerns due to various reductions at the federal level, and just general life events with staff, we lost the traction we anticipated gaining. But we are not discouraged. We have many exciting things on the horizon, such as our third Financial Examiner 1 training school that begins July 8th, as well as our 6th new, more senior level examiners starting this summer. We will continue to work towards that 200 FTE mark as we get towards the end of the fiscal year. And that's it.
Any questions, members?
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so let's go to page 96, and this is the report on the Strategic Support Division. And you may have seen the press release, but I'm happy to announced that we appointed Liliana Abbasi as our Director of Strategic Support. And I want to probably, why don't you start coming up here while I talk a little bit about you. Liliana's been with the department nearly 10 years. She started as an examiner in Dallas and then went to Houston. She took on a new role recently to help us review department policies and examination related policies. And then she has been the one that has been responsible for tracking the legislative reports that you've been getting. So you can thank her or argue with her about that. She is a graduate of A&M and has been involved in the commercial banking school at A&M, and so we're really glad to have Lily here. So Lily, I know this information on here is, they've seen it all the time, but why don't you just kind of make a few comments.
Okay, great. Well, good morning. Again, I'm Lily Abbasi, new director of Strategic Support Division with the Department of Banking. So just to walk you through the information that you have in your packet, page 96 is the Strategic Support Division's activities report. Pages 96 through 101 cover consumer assistance activities. All the information there is normal. We don't have anything that seems unusual at this time. On page 102, you'll find some information on our commissioning process. Currently, we have several staff members in various phases of the commissioning process, and we do anticipate to have several individuals commissioned by calendar year end. So that's a work in progress right now. At the bottom of this page and then on the following are other divisional items of note. Particularly, we have on page 103 our department's financial education efforts. So our consumer assistance supervisor, Shion Corley, co-hosted a financial fitness webinar on May 28th, and we had 17 consumers in attendance. So that's, I'm going to conclude there unless anybody has any questions.
Questions for Lily?
No, just congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. So, Mr. Chairman, unless there are any questions, we'll go to the legal division update and ask General Counsel Robert Nichols to come forward.
Thank you, Commissioner. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commission members. We'll be beginning on page 105 of your packets with the legal division update. For our litigation, there's no change in the first one listed there, but good news on the second case we listed. The case was dismissed with prejudice after a hearing, and so that will be removed, so you won't see that one mentioned again. As far as commissioner orders, he issued four consent orders during this time period. The first is a prohibition order for an EVP, former EVP at Farmers and Merchants Bank. This is an embezzlement of $33,000. The restitution has been repaid, so the commissioner has prohibited him from further participation in the industry in Texas.
No, I'm not related to this individual.
For the record, noted. On the non-depository supervision side, we had three consent orders. The first had to do with BSA AML compliance issues, etc. They're making some good progress to fix those things. And the next two were just unauthorized money transmission. As far as public information requests, we received 23 requests for public information and one public information request to the finance committee. Under gifts, the first item that, as always, just listed as an out of an abundance of caution, there's no issue there. And on the second item, we did return one gift that someone was given after speaking on a panel. That is all I have for the legal division report. Any other questions on that?
Any questions, members?
Okay. Moving right along to the legislative report that begins on page 18108 of your packet. There are a lot of bills listed here, so happy to answer any questions on any of those, but I just wanted to highlight a few to start off with. And we are continuing to watch these. Most of these bills have not been signed into law yet. As the commissioner and Mr. Berry earlier mentioned, that process continues until June 22nd. If the governor doesn't veto them, they still become law if he doesn't sign them into law. So that may happen with a lot of these, I'm not really sure. But the first five on your list were bills that we as a department put forward and asked a member to carry for us. So thankfully they were they went through unscathed. The first one, that's HB 3803, has to do with perpetual care cemeteries and confidentiality. That brings that statute in line with all of our other statutes as far as financial condition information. We had two bills, House Bill 3804 and House Bill 3806, that had to do with bank and trust. We had House Bill 3805 and 3833 had to do with money services. So some positive changes for us there, just some items that we've cleaned up kind of information and things like that, just things we noticed that probably could be done better. So we're thankful to report that those all went through and hopefully will become law soon. I did want to note one that we were very hopeful for, and this has to do with a rule that you all voted to publish last June. This is House Bill 4233, and this has to do with our Chapter 160 under the Finance Code. This is the Digital Asset Service Provider Report bill, and unfortunately, it didn't make it through. You know, you'll recall that you voted to publish the rule that we had to try to fix this issue. We got a lot of comments. We were considering those, and then we found out that this bill was coming forward, so we waited to see what happened. Unfortunately, the legislature did not fix the problem, so we're reviewing and analyzing our options again. And that's all I have for the legislative report, pending your questions. And I will note also, as the commissioner mentioned, we're keeping a close eye on federal legislation too that might affect us. So happy to answer any questions about any of this.
Any questions, members? Mr. Nichols is one. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, as I think the members were notified, items two and three were asked the governor's office to be withdrawn so they could take more time to evaluate them, and so we only have item four.
Very good. Now, so, Mr. Adams will be presenting.
Morning, Chairman, members. Marcus Adams, Deputy General Counsel for the Department of Banking. I think we are on page 134 of the packet with this rule. This is a proposal for a new rule which clarifies the term attorney for purposes of Finance Code Section 152.0049 and the conditions necessary for such an attorney to invoke the exemption. For context, the statutory language exempts an attorney or title company that, in connection with a real property transaction, receives and disperses domestic currency or issues an escrow or trust fund check only on behalf of a party to the transaction. So essentially exempts from money transmission statutes an attorney or regulated title company performing escrow in connection with a real property transaction. A question has repeatedly arisen as regarding the term attorney in that statute and to what context it applies. The proposed rule clarifies that the attorney must be licensed and a member of the State Bar of Texas or a professional corporation organized to provide professional legal services and must receive and disperse the contemplated escrow or trust funds in the course of providing legal representation. Given the context of the statute, this interpretation, we were sure to reach out to TDI, Texas Department of Insurance, review the insurance code comparable statutes, and believe this interpretation is consistent with comparable provisions of the insurance code. It's also important to note that this language, if you recall, Chapter 152 was adopted last session. This language was carried over from the prior Chapter 151. And so this interpretation is how the department has historically interpreted this statute, although it has never been put into a rule prior to now. So ultimately, this really just simply means that the private business activities of a person who incidentally holds a law license separate from the person's practice of a law remains subject to licensure. And I'm happy to answer any questions you all have.
Any questions, members? Is there anyone wishing to address the commission for the Department of Banking Rule Item Number 4 in the audience today? Seeing no one, do I hear a motion to approve the proposal and publication for comment of New 7 Tech Part 2, Chapter 33, Subsection 33.55, concerning clarification of Texas Finance Code, Subsection 152.004, Paragraph 9.
Laura Warren, so moved.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Marty Green, second.
Thank you very much, sir. Members, any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Ayes have it. Motion carries.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. That concludes our report, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Members, item D, Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner is next. Commissioner Pettijohn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving to just a couple of economic item reports, we've gotten some of the data from Q1 2025, and not terribly surprising, but household debt continues to increase. It increased by $167 billion in Q1, but interestingly, credit card and auto balances fell, which was a rare dual decline not seen since 2011. Debt balance per capita in Texas increased again to $59,000 in Q1, but still remains below the national average, which you would expect. Gaps may be a little bit narrower, but it's still below the national average. And then lastly, not Q1, but in May, we've all been watching certainly the news and a lot of the things that are going on in the economy, but consumer confidence partially rebounded in May, but still stands below sort of a threshold of uncertainty that tends to signal potential recession ahead. This short-term outlook tracks expectations for the next few months regarding business conditions, employment, and income. It's likely heavily influenced by some of the events going on and economic uncertainties and tariffs and geopolitical concerns, I'm sure, that affect that consumer confidence. So those are probably familiar with all of those from other news reports, but I just thought I'd share those as we get started. Moving into the reports on page 139 on our Consumer Protection and Consumer Assistance Report, I only have a couple of things. Again, we're sort of in the mid-quarter reports. You've had Q2 reports. Q3 will be coming in our next meeting. We have a few little updates as of April, but I'm not going to dwell on them a whole lot. We are seeing all of our industries at acceptable levels of compliance over our 85% benchmark, which is great. We are very, very grateful for that and appreciate the good work of the industry on getting those compliance rates and keeping them up. And the department is on track to meet our annual production targets or examination completion targets. It's down a little bit year, you know, pro rata in April, but we're expecting by the end of May, we'll be back. Well, I know we are back on track already, certainly in June. So, and also, even though our report down at the bottom of page 139 shows year over year, we're down about 9%. We do have a little bit smaller target this year, just based upon staffing and needs, but we're down a little, about 9%. But again, we expect to meet our targets by the end of the year. We did start a new financial examiner training class. Two new financial examiners began with us on June the 2nd, and they are well underway and doing well in their training class. One of them has some industry experience, and so we're the double bonus for us to start someone with some industry experience as well. So we are working on that. We are also working to deal with the preparation and training to move to the statewide examination system. You'll hear more about that in August, but we've been doing a lot of training. We're working through some examinations. We've done several dozen examinations in that system already, and we'll be moving to a full-scale use of that system for one group of our licensees beginning in September. Moving on to investigation activity, nothing particularly to note, except for that we're just seeing an increase in pawn investigations, and we've seen a decrease in motor vehicle sales finance investigations. Those are just sort of some isolated issues that are happening, had happened last year in motor vehicle, and a few issues. Nothing terribly concerning, though, in the pawn area right now. But we monitor that, and we're on track with those. Consumer assistance activity, again, nothing. It's very consistent year over year. The complaints and all the activity seems consistent with what we've seen. So nothing, normal activity, nothing unusual to report. Licensing activity is on page 144. And the primary item that I wanted to discuss here relates to the transition to NMLS for the property tax lenders. The transition period concluded during May. So we were able to transition. 90% of our current property tax lenders did submit their application to transition into NMLS. The other 10%, some of them have chosen to surrender their licenses. Again, this was a small group that we went through first. And some of them we don't believe that there's any that are outstanding that are going to be affected that failed to transfer, but there may be one or two that we haven't heard from yet, but we'll cross that bridge when we get there. But we are working to try to process those currently. Each application must be processed. And so we have a bit of a workload to work through here on these particular transition applications.
May I have something?
Sure.
When they're transferred, do they have to take a test or anything?
No.
It's
switching the systems from our ALEKS system. And then we're transitioning them over to, so it's the company licenses right now. So there's no individual
like mortgage people have.
Yeah, but that's not the mortgage loan. It's not the originators. It'd be the mortgage companies or something like that. I mean, so it's at the company level. But they do, you know, NMLS is used heavily also for non-bank activity outside of mortgage, non-bank consumer finance, debt activity, money services business. There's a number of other types of activities that that platform can be used for. So we're transitioning these groups. So the property tax lenders have their transition period is concluded. We are busily preparing for the regulated lender group, which is a much larger group, and their transition period will open on July 15th for a period of 60 days. We've got about 785 companies that will need to transfer or transition to NMLS and file their transition applications. And so they are preparing. We're communicating with them, sending out their first communication related to this to prepare them for what's ahead and what they need to do to transition their companies before the deadline. It'll be open until middle of September or about September 13th. And so we, there's a lot ahead as we work to transfer these 786 companies through the next few months. But that'll be an exciting time. We're excited to get them on NMLS and move forward with that process. Moving on to page 145, you just see the financial education events we've been involved in. And you heard about the webinar from banking that we co-hosted with them, but there's some other events we've been able to participate in financial education. Number of communication and the communication and the other events outreach we've been involved in. I did want to mention that towards the end of May, there were three of us on the senior staff that attended the annual meeting of the National Association of Consumer Credit Administrators. And Matt Nance was elected as the first vice president. So he's an officer in that organization. We're pretty involved in that. Matt's going to be responsible for chairing the Nationwide Examiner Conference next fall. So he'll be working on that examiner training conference. But there was a lot of great information, a lot of networking, a lot of emerging issues that state regulators are working on together. So it was a good opportunity to network with our colleagues on those issues and gain a lot of valuable information. So we were grateful to participate in that. I don't really have much to mention in the way of HR. We're continuing to work through some issues there, but it fills some recent positions. I did want to pause on 147 to talk about information technology and mention that we have been involved in it's turned into a pretty significant project for us related, and I may have mentioned some of this before, but to transition to the new Texas payment engine. Currently, our regulatory platform, Alex, connects. It basically does a handoff to Texas.gov and the payment engine that's operated at Texas.gov. And DIR has awarded a contract to a different vendor to operate the Texas payment engine. And that came with new sets of specifications that we need to adhere to. So we have been working, and our contractors have been working, our vendor has been working on all the programming changes that we have needed to be able to transition or migrate to this new payment engine. We initially had been scheduled for a June 23rd launch date that has recently got pushed back to July 14th. So we are continuing to work. We believe we've done all the testing. We believe that it's fairly well ready to go, but it's been a pretty heavy lift related to this Texas payment engine shift. And it's not something that it was sort of one of those unfunded mandates, you might say, and it certainly has required a lot of resources to ensure that we are able to continue to accept electronic payments through Texas.gov. But we've done our part. Hopefully that will go smoothly in the next few weeks. With that, I'm happy to answer any operational questions. And if there are not any, we're ready for Matt Nance to provide the legal report.
Morning, Mr. Nance.
Good morning, Matt Nance, General Counsel, Office of Consumer Credit Commissioner. Our legal department report starts on page 148. Starting with our two SOA cases, those are listed on page 148. Wanted to mention the first one is a pawn shop employee license application denial case. That hearing was earlier this week. The applicant did not appear at the hearing, so it was a default. We're awaiting an order of default dismissal from the administrative law judge on that one. The second one is set for a hearing date in September, but we're gonna keep working with that applicant to see if we can resolve some of those license issues before the hearing, but that hearing is scheduled for September. Going on to page 150, I want to mention a couple items on rulemaking. We're not presenting any rules at this meeting, but similar to what Mr. Berry mentioned for SML, we anticipate possibly in August rules amending our military licensing rules for our two types of individual licenses, residential mortgage loan originators and pawn shop employees, to conform to some of these recent bills on military licensing for individuals, HB 5629 and SB 1818. And also in the future, in the next few months, possible rule proposals on a property tax lender rule review and possibly additional rules to implement the transition to the NMLS system. So that's on rulemaking. Federal rulemaking, we do continue to follow developments at the federal level. One recent development from the CFPB is a proposal to rescind a rule we had talked about last year on registration of non-bank enforcement orders. So we'll continue to follow the evolving situation at the federal level. And finally, last item I wanted to mention on page 150 is on public information. We received an open records letter ruling on a public information request that needed to be referred to the Office of the Attorney General. The requester had asked for information about an OCCC investigation. It was referred to the OAG, and the OCCC argued that the information should be withheld because OCCC investigation information is confidential under the Texas Finance Code. And we successfully argued that the OAG agreed with the OCCC and ruled that the OCCC must withhold that investigation information because it was confidential under the Finance Code. Happy to answer any questions about the legal report. If not, I will move on to the summary of legislation. All right, so we have a summary of legislation that starts on page 151. I really just wanted to highlight four of the most significant bills on here, but happy to answer any questions. We are still, as was mentioned previously, awaiting the end of the governor's period for vetoing or approving bills. First one I wanted to highlight is on page 151. It's House Bill 700. So this, if it's not vetoed by the governor, it would be a new area of regulation and a new registration for our agency for commercial sales-based financing transactions. So these are business-to-business financing transactions where there's an advance and it's repaid based on the company's sales or receipts. It's a little bit different from traditional loans or traditional factoring kind of relationships. It's also known as a merchant cash advance. We're still learning about this transaction. This is not particularly something we sought out or based on one of our recommendations, but we are, you know, learning more about this industry. And there's an implementation period where by the end of 2026, we would have a registration system set up. And the legislature has directed the commission to adopt rules by September of 2026. So assuming this moves forward, we'll have a period of trying to work with stakeholders, make sure we have a good understanding of this new business-to-business financing transaction.
But it holds a lot of similarities with another the other things that we do. So it's sort of in the family kind of.
The structure is similar to some of our other areas in that there's a registration requirement and disclosure requirements. So yeah, structurally it has some of the similar features to some of our other regulated areas.
Can I ask you a question? Sure. I know we're still trying to wrap our arms around a bit. What's the volume size? I mean, every time, how many transactions historically or do we have any sense of that?
I don't have a sense of the volume. I do know there are about four or five other states that regulate this activity. And so I'm aware that there are a couple of hundred companies that are registered in each of these other states, but it's a growing activity. And there's been a lot of concerns about some of the practices involved in this particular area for small businesses.
Do you mind elaborating just a little? I want to understand what they're doing.
All right, Matt, you
want to... Sure. Yeah, and our understanding is that you have this provider that will provide an advance of money to a business.
Here's my question. How are they different than factoring?
Right. So, factoring
is just like above usury lending, basically.
Well, our understanding
as a guy that when I was young, I had to do it. It was like loan shark.
Well,
yeah. No, it is. I mean, it's legal.
And Yeah, this is kind of even outside of traditional factoring, but in traditional factoring, the kind of factoring company, the provider of the financing will purchase a set of receivables, right, from a business. So a business will have an existing account.
Incredible discount.
Yeah, right, right.
Right, so, and yeah, the business gets cash and they're selling, you know, their accounts receivable to the factoring provider. And our understanding is also that's typically kind of a one and done transaction.
Right.
Where that's a single purchase.
Enforcing it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of traditional factoring. In this, the provider will make an advance and expect repayment, but in payment amounts that are based on future sales and revenue.
Rather than future.
So they may take 20% of your receipts every week or whatever, but it's going to be a continuing, whatever the percentage is agreed to, but it's percentage of the sales.
Is it looked at as traditional collateral? You know, factoring, you're selling.
Yeah.
You're selling a receivable.
Yeah. Here, they're just taking an interest in the sales percentage.
And so it's prospective.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's like a traditional loan, and some folks have argued that it is a loan.
Yeah.
And but instead of having a set payment schedule, you have payment amounts that vary based on incoming sales and revenue.
But it's presumably fairly high risk, and the compensation, I mean, again, there's been some concerns about the practices, which is why this bill is here, because of the concerns about the practice.
Factoring is high risk. I mean, that's why people do it.
Yeah.
Both sides.
So we'll be starting stakeholder meetings and some things like that as we begin to work through this process. But we've got, it's got a fairly long period before
it should be regulated. I didn't know this being done.
Right. Okay, so that's House Bills.
In particular, I wanted to comment on, you may have said this, but I just want to reemphasize that the Finance Commission is in a position to adopt rules on practices considered to be unfair, misleading, or that take unreasonable advantage of a recipient's lack of understanding. So that's the process we're going to begin going through is to try to begin to create some guardrails for rulemaking ultimately, you know, into next year. So.
Okay, the second significant one I want to highlight is top of page 152, motor vehicle sales finance convenience fees, House Bill 4134. So this is in motor vehicle credit sales that we regulate under chapter 348 of the finance code. This does authorize fees for electronic payment, payment by credit card, debit card, or other electronic method with some parameters. The fee needs to be reasonably related to the expense incurred by the creditor. There's a maximum amount, and the creditor has to allow the consumer to make payment by a method other than electronic payment that doesn't incur the fee, so at least one free method. So this was previously something we found in exams required refunding because as of today it's not authorized, but if this bill goes forward there'll be a method to allow these sort of expedited electronic and possibly telephone payments. Third one is at the bottom of page 152, solar panel retailer registration. So this is another new area of regulation, not one that we would administer. It would be administered by TDLR, but under this bill, solar retailers and solar salespersons would be required to register with the Texas Department of Licensing and Regulation. Some of these solar panel transactions are financed, and under this bill, TDLR would be working with our agency, the OCCC, in developing some contract language and disclosures for the sales of solar panels. And finally, I wanted to mention on page 153, House Bill 27, adding personal financial literacy to the required high school curriculum for Texas high schoolers. Of course, personal financial literacy is a significant topic for the commissioner and the agency. This adds a half credit in personal financial literacy to the requirements for high school education. Currently, that's kind of an optional part of the economics half credit. This makes it required, and it would be scheduled to apply to students entering the ninth grade in the 2026 to 2027 school year.
Bravo. All right. It's about time.
Was that signed yet?
As of this morning, it hasn't been signed or vetoed yet.
And it passed both houses.
Yes.
Overwhelmingly, it had a lot of support. And people have been working on this for a long time, and it hasn't always attained that level of support. But
remind us, if it's not signed.
If it's not signed, it becomes law. And so one of the funding priorities that you approved earlier today for the Texas Financial Education Endowment includes K-12. And so our funding cycle might not align well for this time around for some of this, but we'll see but we'll expect a lot of activity if this bill becomes law in personal financial literacy at the high school level. So very much, I think it's a great change to for our young people.
So none of the other bills, as of when I checked earlier this morning, had been vetoed. The other bills, there was a kind of emphasis on cybersecurity and AI issues affecting state agencies. I didn't have any prepared remarks necessarily, but I'm happy to answer questions if there are any on the remaining bills.
Any questions? Congratulations on your post at the NACA as the first vice president.
Thanks, sir. All right. Thank you.
That concludes our report, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, ma'am. Members, any comments or questions? Thank you for your attention and your attendance today. It's very difficult, I know, this time of year to coordinate everybody's schedules with the holidays and work, but thank you for being here. There being no further business discussed, this meeting of the Finance Commission is now adjourned. The time is 11:20 a.m. Thank you.